And welcome back. Here we are. Module 6 of 6. So we're in the 6th inning.
Yes.
Oh, that doesn't work. That doesn't map right.
No, it doesn't map right.
But we're in the final stretch
here. But it makes sense to us at this time.
Yeah. For at some this point,
reason.
We get it.
Yeah.
How about if you take us into this next module, Michael, so I can take a drink?
We've heard it. So
it's water.
This module is labeled deployment, and in general, what we're going to be looking at, since this is at the end, you might think, well, deployment's the final stretch. We're going to be actually considering some things that you should be doing throughout the life of the application that would lead up to your final submitting to the store. This is one of those examples where if you are creating an app that's designed for the Windows Store and you don't deploy and you don't submit, no one really does benefit from that app. If you think about it, in days of old, there could have been an MSI or an executable you can pass around, and that's great. But this one's different. This one ultimately leads to a store of some kind. I know there's enterprise strategies out there, but at the end of the day, especially at the end of this day, we are definitely seeking out and hoping that you're going to really, really do well in the store with your app. There is a monetization aspect of creating your app and putting it in the store. So we're going to be discussing that here too. So if you take a look at my screen, you can start to see, thank you, all of you who've been with us up to this point. And now we're going to go into some important topics. Check out these topics. So trial functionality in your app is going to be one of those topics. Then we've had some, in fact, Jeremy touched on a few areas for error handling. I'm going to showcase and reemphasize some of the things he said and maybe show an example of things to think about when you're implementing error handling in your own apps. Jeremy's going to show us a very cool way that you can implement test strategies. And I have to say, I really am looking forward to that because we're in a script world, and I think it makes sense that we really implement a test strategy. And then we're going to close the session by considering, actually, I will even phrase this as almost a Visual Studio commercial in a good way, because there are some features within Visual Studio that really can help you, especially for these kind of apps, for Windows Store apps written in JavaScript. There is a way for you to definitely diagnose and monitor them and really get a lot of rich data about it that can be beneficial for you in order to really gain where is this app really spending a lot of its time doing a lot of work and so forth. So you're going to see how easy it is to get started with that. But before we go any further, I do also want to mention, as a reminder, if you have not done the poll as of yet, please engage with that poll. Very important to get your feedback, and we definitely appreciate it. So you can multitask, you can do your asynchronous promise that you'll do that, and also pay attention to us. Does that sound good? All right, let's talk now about why offer a trial of your app. So that question in itself kind of has another question that surrounds it, and that is, well, what are your options for the store in terms of your app? Think of it this way. The first option that you have is to put your application out there absolutely free with no monetization at all. And if you think that's silly, then you can call me silly, because at this time, that is what Tile of Time is. It is a completely free app. It doesn't even have any ads in it. It's just a completely free app that's just sitting out there in the store. What are my motivation? I want to get an app out there. I think it's important that everyone thinks about the seriousness of the times that we're living in. There's never going to be a time like this again where you can build a brand and get your name, your presence, your idea into the store this early in the game. You're not going to get this again. So highly recommend that you think that way. Even if I wasn't completely ready, I'm putting something into the store because I want to build my brand. So you got to think about the branding piece, because you're not going to get this opportunity again.
You know what I always say is it's important to define your scope really well. It's important to get that. We're developers. We've got big ideas, and that's awesome. But reduce the scope of your app to just its essence, just the one or two or three things at most that your app is really great at, and make it do those things really well and publish it. And you can always do updates, and you can always, you know, push another app or another version, things like that. As an example, I wrote an app called CamView that's in the store now. CamView only works with one model of webcam. It looks at IP cameras, but instead of looking at all IP cameras, it only looks at one. Now, of course, there's all kinds of ideas for what more I could do with IP camera app, but I just wanted to get it out. So when I wrote it, I got it out and I put in the specs that this only works with one kind of camera. You need to have this kind of camera. And now I'm working on a new version, and it's, you know, hopefully going to be out before too terribly long. I'm not quite done with it yet, and it has a lot more functionality in it already.
So I think that really tells a story. And I really appreciate the way that Jeremy stated this. I kind of said it poorly by saying, even if I'm not ready. That wasn't really true. You don't want to send something that's unfinished into the store. But it's okay if it's not feature complete from your own perspective. Maybe you wish there were more features in there. But whatever you have, finish it, but reduce the scope and actually get it in there. So that kind of falls right back into this question, so why offer a trial? Well, then the broader question, what are your options? So it could be free, or you can set a price to your app. You could say, I want to charge $1.49 or $3 or whatever the case is, and you can choose your price for that. Now let's talk about what happens if you do actually choose to make the user pay for your app. What do you think the studies show? What do you think?
I think that everybody else is probably a little bit like me, in that if they see an app that costs whatever, $1, $2, $3, and there's no trial version, there's no way.
So is that true of everybody? Does everybody feel that way? No. But the majority do. That's the facts that you have to take into play. There's been various studies, and I don't even want to quote a number, although I have one in my head. I'll just simply say, proportionately, it's a phenomenal number of how many people will not get your app by merit of you having an upfront cost. But why? I kind of have that on the screen here. Cost is a barrier to entry when value isn't proven. People will buy something if there is a proven value, such as a proven reputation of somebody who built a great app before. Well, they may say, well, if they claim they're doing this, then I'll go ahead and buy the app. But if we're brand new to the store and you're just trying to make some headway and there's no proof of value to your app other than what you claim, you might want to consider trial capabilities, because now you're giving an opportunity for the consumer to make a choice. And this is your opportunity to say, let me get them hooked. Let me really make them want this app. And so that's why you want to offer trial capability. So the probability of install is what you need. You want your app as installed as many, many the consumer's desks or PCs as possible, or devices. So one way to do that is offering it free. That's not the only way, but just remember, is your value proposition enough for them to actually pay for it right now? If you don't think so, you might want to consider trial capabilities. Now, trial capabilities aren't the only way that you can make money. I'm going to discuss how you can offer a trial, but another way that you can make money, which we'll also look into a little bit, is in-app purchases, which means maybe the app is free, but once you get involved with it enough, maybe there's a way for you to purchase a feature or purchase something within the app that's compelling, and then the user might want to do that in order to say, hey, I like what I have so far, let me go ahead and do this. So several ways that it can be done. That said, we're going to take a look at another MSDN sample app. I'm going to move over to it right now. I already have it open. All you'd have to look for is trial app by going to file, new project, and, you know, online, look for trial. But I wanted to focus right here on the trialmode.js file, which is a file that's sitting in the Solution Explorer once you have it downloaded. And I specifically have, at this moment, this line is highlighted. What you're seeing here is there's a local variable that's being created in this application, and it's referencing windows.applicationmodel.store.currentAppSimulator. The reason why we're taking a look at this, and I think this is great, is This here allows us the ability to treat our app as if it were coming from the store. And that's great. I mean, if you think about it, if you're going to be offering trial or full product or convert from a trial to a full product, how are you going to be able to test this outside of the store? That's really the scenario. How can you truly test it? This is how it's done. You create this particular line in your code somewhere that sets a reference to the current app simulator. Now, if you're thinking in your mind right now, okay, I do that, what happens when I submit to the store if I have this current app simulator referenced in the code? Here's the answer. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
It will fail. I shouldn't take so much pleasure in saying that, but I just wanted to be clear. Don't leave your app like this. But there is something you should do, and it's so easy, and this is why I'm making it very clear why it's like one of the first lines that's in this particular script file. So let's go back and look at that line. See, var current app currently equals the current app simulator. However, right before you do, send this off to the store, you see this area here that I have that is highlighted? This, you backspace. And what do you have left? Just store.currentApp. Now you submit it. Now it will pass as long as you didn't make any other mistakes. But don't make the mistake of leaving the word simulator. Now this current app, everywhere you're using it within the app to actually do the checking for trial and purchasing and all that kind of stuff will be real. So don't forget that step. Remember, all you have to do is remove the word simulator, and then the current app is the one you're going to use instead. So what kind of things can you do? Well, I'm going to go ahead and run this project first, so that you can kind of see the scenario, what it's doing. We're looking at the scenario of being in trial mode at this time. In trial mode, I can say, well, one of the things that you could do with the trial is you can set an expiration. So the trial period is going to look at the expiration date that was defined by yourself, and you can find out how many more days are left. The reason why it would be beneficial for you to query this within your application, you're thinking, well, if you set the trial period, what's the point of querying it within your app? Well, it gives you an opportunity that every time the app is launched, maybe you want to send a little reminder message to them. Hey, guess what? Your trial period is going to end soon. Wouldn't you just love to have a free, or not the free, the full version of this app? So it's a way for you to actually nudge or prod the user and remind them that their expiration period is coming up. The other thing you could do is query if it's in trial mode or not. So down at the bottom, it's saying you're using the trial version of this app. And of course, the code for that is in there. I can click on purchased, and it's going to say, no, hey, remember, you're using the trial version of this app. So there's a way for you to read the current license state to determine whether or not you are in trial mode, or if someone's attempting to do something that would be in purchase mode. We're not there yet. But now let's buy the app. Let's say we're going to buy the app for $4.99. Whoa. We saw the value proposition. We click buy app. Now you can see our simulated store is prompting us and saying, hey, we're going to go ahead and simulate this purchase. Are you ready to continue? I will say OK. And now it says you've upgraded your app to the fully licensed version. So if I click on purchased again, now it's going to say, yep, you're using the fully licensed version of the app. If I click on trial mode, it says you no longer have the trial version of this app. Now, what this equates to from your perspective as the developer who's putting this together is that you have the ability within your code to ask these questions yourself. And of course, that is going to dictate the direction of what features you're going to enable or disable for your particular users. The same could be true with in-app purchases. In-app purchases are extraordinarily a wise choice in terms of how you can monetize from your apps. If your app is free, but you have some products within the app that you could sell, and what would be an example of a product that could be sold in the store? Let me give you one that's a real popular one. There's a lot of people that like to play simulation type games. You know, I'm gonna build a farm, or I'm gonna build a city, or whatever the case is. And when these games are created, first of all, they're usually always free. Everybody always wants to download and create their own version of a farm or a city or whatever the case is. But then inevitably the way I see it is that someone gets really emotionally attached to their creation. And now all of a sudden they can see that if they only had X amount of points or X amount of gold pieces, they can get the little pink cottage and put it in that corner. So all of a sudden they would never buy this app. They'd never buy it. But now they're willing to pay money for the little pink cottage to go into the corner. And I'm not being silly. There's a lot of money there. Huge money. Maybe you would like to try to create something in terms of an app. I'll give you another example. There's painting or drawing type applications that are out there that may offer you just one type of pen stroke, but maybe the way it works, you're like, wow, that just follows. I can feel that stylus in my pen, in my hand with this new Surface Pro, and the pressure sensitive thing is so good. I wish I could do this in multiple colors. I wish I could do this with a different type of a pen stroke. And you know what? That could be an in-app purchase. For $1.49, I'll give you some colors. People will instantly, especially once they've created their beautiful artwork, now they need to see it with all the different features. That's a way that you can start to think about using this effectively for monetization. So without going into this much more in terms of concept, I just want to indicate to you that this is a fantastic sample that MSDN has provided for you to see that most of these are one-liners in code. They're mostly if statements that say, if this condition is true or not, how are you going to respond? And then usually the ability to make the purchase or so is just that simple. It's through one or two lines of code. So please download this one, especially if you're going to be using these kind of monetization capabilities within your app. So I'm going to go back over into our presentation. Before I get into the design for error handling, I also want to make...
Actually, how about please. If you want the rest of Module 6, you're going to have to pay $1.49. How do you like that?
I love it. That's great. It's a new thing with MVA, you know, where now they're going to say it's a buck to continue watching the video.
No, this isn't MVA. This is straight from Code Foster.
So Code Foster. I'm sorry. That's where the monetization is.
I'm going to put my PayPal email address in the chat real
quick. There you go. That's a smart idea. The other way that you can make money, and in fact, I'm going to ask Jeremy to do me a favor real quick. I'm going to talk about it, and then he's going to actually put the link or the ability for you to get more detail on this, and that is if you can find the post on Mr. Ashley.
Great.
So the story here is you can also create an app, make it free, and never charge for anything. Kind of sort of like I'm doing with my Tile of Time app, but one exception. You could put ads into your app. And if you put ads into your app, you might find that there's a monetization there that is wonderful. So what I asked Jeremy to do was to look up some information that is talking about how one developer that we are colleagues with has actually done so. He's created a game, and out of the kindness of his heart, he has revealed his financial status to many people. He wrote a blog about it, and now you can find out what kind of monetization value there is. And Jeremy, do you happen to have that blog post or
link? I have it.
Link?
It's going in. Here we go.
So you're typing it
into the chat window.
Into the chat window.
Yep.
Okay, so if you want to know more about that, then you can go ahead and click that link that Jeremy is going to provide. Let's just say we're not talking hundreds of dollars.
We're talking thousands?
We're talking thousands of dollars each month. How many thousands? Go find out from Jeremy's link. Just on ads. That's it. It's a nice way to monetize. Okay. Now, let's say that that developer who's making all that money every month blew it. And he released the app, and the app looked good, but it kept crashing. That would not be good, because then he probably wouldn't be making this much money. So the next thing that we're going to talk about is how you can design your app to really be proactive about error management and error handling. And the way we're going to do that is I'm going to step through a couple practices that I wrote. I'm going to put this on the screen. This is a blog entry I did on JavaScript for Windows Store apps, error handling specifically. And let's just talk about some of the basics. So right here, you can see that you can create a variable called x and make it equal 4. Then, elsewhere in code, you could say, I'm going to make x equal 4 again, except this time it'll just be the word 4 in the string. There is nothing wrong with that. That is absolutely valid. Could it be possible, though, that it could introduce an error into your app someday? Sure, because you don't know if you're treating it as a number or if you're treating it as a string. So that kind of assumption, especially in JavaScript, a language that's not strongly typed, that's what you have to be aware of. So we're going to share some features that you should be aware of on when you're developing, especially within Visual Studio, how you can make sure that you can avoid errors, and then stay ahead of them. Even little misspellings can get you. VARR x equals 4. That will actually cause in Visual Studio this kind of error message. But notice the error message. I thought it was really funny. If you actually look at it, it says, here's the error. Expected a semicolon. Is that really what the issue is? Is a semicolon missing on that line? You know, if you're not careful, you will be looking all over for a line missing a semicolon when the real issue is that the misspelling of VAR was the issue. So keep those things in mind so that you're not spending needless time trying to search for something, because sometimes you can have misleading statements. Now, here is something that's important. We've been seeing try catches. Actually, Jeremy, you've been showing try catch blocks all day long, and that's great. That should be in an app, especially when we're going to do something potentially that's going to cause an exception. What you do in your catch block or your finally block is important. And there is one rule of thumb I've always had that I consider a no-no, and that is sometimes developers, what they'll want to do is they'll want to put a try catch block in. But in their catch block, they'll do absolutely nothing. Because their reasoning is, I just want to make sure it doesn't crash my app. You can understand why they're thinking this way, and I'm not faulting such good intentions. But is nothing the only option inside of your catch block or finally block? Do you have any thoughts on this?
I do. I think we should probably go with your thoughts, though.
Well, my thought is this. At the very minimum, if you're going to be in a try-catch block and your only real concern is, I just don't want it to cause an exception if something goes wrong in the try, what you can do in the catch is just log it. If anything else, just log what happened. Use some kind of utility, a utility that, in fact, could be turned off or on, or kind of like a trace thing, but do something. Because if something does go wrong, inevitably you might want to know, why did it go wrong? And you'll pat yourself on the back later. You'll be like, oh, I'm so glad I put that in that catch block, because now I was able to find it so quick. If you don't, what you'll do is you'll spend all this time going, next line, in the debugger, you know, next line. Wasn't that. See, that's not nearly as effective as having a way to quickly see the output trace of something. And you'll thank yourself if you did that by putting something in the catch block that says, okay, this is what happened. So what are your options? What you can put in there, that's what I'm going to talk about next.
I'll tell you what I put in there sometimes. Actually, if you catch but do nothing with an exception, you swallow the exception, it's actually one of the very difficult exceptions, bugs to find.
It is.
In an app.
Yes.
So, but there are a few cases where at least in, you know, at least for the time being, it makes sense to do it. I always put in there a comment that just says, gulp. I've swallowed an exception. And that way, if I do run into that error, I can always go back and just search my app for the word gulp. I'll find where I was swallowing errors and check to make sure that that wasn't the case.
So at least he put a comment in there. But I feel personally that there's nothing wrong with just at least having something in there that indicates, hey, here's what potentially would have happened if you're going to read that error information. Although a comment like that would at least let you find it quickly. Yeah. So one of the things that you can do is you can log it. And there is a provision to do so. It's the winjs.log. You might say, in fact, in most of the MSDN samples, you're going to see that used quite a bit. The winjs.log. But what is so funny to me about the use of this particular method is that by default, if you call it, it will cause an error. And I just think that's hilarious, because here we have something that can help us to log potential things that went wrong, and yet invalid use of it will cause an error. And the invalid use of it is just using it without initializing it. What is meant by that is that the log method itself is nothing until it's initialized, until something makes it do something. So back to the screen, one way that you can initialize it is through this utility called winjs.utilities.startlog. You can put this somewhere very early into the lifecycle of your application, and what that does is it initializes the log method so you can use it. And what it does is it writes to the output in Visual Studio for you. So everything that you do goes to an output window in Visual Studio. That's nice, because if something goes wrong, you can just go to the output window and say, okay, there's what the message was. Great. Now, the start log does take in some parameters that can be helpful and useful for you to kind of do some filtering. If you don't want to do that, you can also define your own log method. So in other words, you'd say winjs.log equals, and then you provide your own functionality as to what does it mean to have logging. So you can create your own custom logging scenario there. But that big red statement, if you don't initialize it, it's going to say, what's this log thing? You know, that's what you're going to get, and so it's not going to work. Now, we heard from Mr. Jeremy the use of that double ampersand. And I'm going to say this is such a wonderful thing to do. Notice here that in the first example, if I just call winjs.log, the reason why I called it risky is because it is. How do I know for sure that log was initialized? Even if I trust myself, maybe I don't. I don't want to trust myself when I code anymore. I want to trust that it actually will work. So just like what was mentioned by Jeremy before, if this side of the equation returns false because log doesn't exist, it never goes over here. It never even attempts it. That's one of the advantages of having a short-circuited AND, which is what that is. It's just saying, okay, I'm just going to cut out. If this is false, we already know we're false. It's basically what it's saying. There's no need to see if the other side's true or false, because we've already considered the whole equation to be false. Another way that you can do this, or another example of something very similar, is in this example for echo name. Notice we're creating a function where we're passing name in as an argument. Now, if we want to make sure that this is going to work, if you look at the example below where it says, let me call echo name without an argument, and let me call echo name with an argument. This is our way of saying, let's provide a default behavior for name if one wasn't provided. So that's when you use the double pipeline operator. If the first part of the equation returns true, it will use it, and there's no need to go any further. But if it's false, then it's going to go ahead and return that John Doe. This is a very nice thing that you can implement in your code, because once again, if you wanted to work with the idea of what if it doesn't get called the way that I expect it to, then you had like a safety net in there. Yet what happens if you call it with the number 4? Now uppercase, which was what it's doing at the top of the screen, will fail, because that doesn't support 2 uppercase. So how can you override that? Well, there's where you can say, and not only if name, but if it has a 2 uppercase, then we can safely call it. So these are ways, what we're trying to do is think in terms of, if I'm going to be making calls and I don't trust what's coming to me, what can I do to get as much trust into the things that I'm using as possible. So there's a variety of things on the screen here in terms of how you can actually check what the type of something is. At the end of the day, I would highly recommend you to take a look at this function. I'm not going to go into it at this moment, but this function can give you what I would call a true value of the type of something by passing something in and actually seeing what it is and then returning whether or not it is that or not. And so examples of its use are down below where it's like, is type ABC of string true? Is type new string ABC a string true? Is type 4 an error would be thrown? So because we, you know, of what? You know, we didn't provide what the other argument is. So now, if we start to think of error handling, one of the things that you can also do is you can make sure that you can add to your application an error event or an error. It listens for errors that go unhandled. So you could do this right here at the beginning in your default.js. What would you do if there's an error that handles unhandled in your app? Notice this is off of the app itself, app.addEventListener error. So what do you want to do if that happens? You can also do this at the page level. Notice that we usually see a ready event. You can also implement an error. And the error, once again, is going to say, what do you want to do? In this case, maybe I'm going to say, well, if there's a log available to be initialized, let's go ahead and show what the error message is. And the other things that you see there are kind of like your own category and the level of that type of error. So that's what demo and error is. It's just part of the signature of that log method, which is message, category, and, you know, type. Then we have the when promises are broken. We talked, Jeremy went at length about promises, and now what happens if a promise fails? This example, this whole example here that you see on the screen is inside of Code Show right now. It's in the error area, and I'm going to go ahead and demo it right now. So I'm going to go over to the Code Show demo and go to the errors area, exception handling. And the idea here is calling a promise, and this time the promise has been started. I have a progress indicator at the bottom letting me know what's going on, and the promise was complete. That's great. Now I'm going to call a promise that's chained, and as you'll recall from what Jeremy stated, a chained promise means that when the one asynchronous method is done, then it will do another one, and then it will do another one, and finally it will be done. So when I click on that one, first chain is started, second chain is started, but then what happens if something went wrong? That muhahaha is an error message that occurred because this chain had something go wrong in it. What's interesting is to see the code for this, because cruising over here, and I'll find that chained information, which was right there. And let me get into that. So what happened is you can see the line in the middle of the screen where it says return do async fail. That fail string is actually checked inside of that do async method. And if it sees that that's the argument, it actually throws an error. I'm throwing one. Isn't that horrible? I'm throwing the error. But the other thing that we talked about was when you're doing any kind of promises, and this is a very key thing for promises, especially when they're chained. Notice here that each one of these promises has a completed function, comma, null, comma, do progress. Now, Jeremy, what would we think would go where the null is? What's the second part of that equation for promises?
The error function.
Error function. So you know what I'm saying here? I'm saying don't have, you don't want to have a null there. Or why would you have a null there? And the reason for this is in a chained promise, you can defer the error handling to it all the way at the done level. Look at the done at the bottom. Notice its completed event is null, but I do have a do error function that it calls. For those of you who have a background in like multiple try catch finally blocks, can you almost see that happening here? The then is kind of like a catch in a way. But the done is the finally. So even if any of the above thens fail, my done will capture it, and the do error only needs to be stated once. That's a nice feature for when you're chaining these promises, is you can have like kind of one error management system instead of having to repeat it in every single one of those. So that's pretty cool. I forgot.
And I guess I wouldn't use that technique if I wanted to handle the different then blocks on their own, right? I could still give them their own error.
That's correct. You're absolutely correct. The other thing that you could do is you can join a chain, and that sounds almost like you're trying to get your head wrapped around what a chaining of promises is, and now you can actually join them together. But essentially what you're doing, if you're going to join or do a chain join, is you're having them all fire asynchronously at the same time.
I think the best example in CodeShow to wrap your head around that is to go look at the various Netflix samples, because some of them wait until each promise is fulfilled, and then they put that movie, in the Netflix case, on the screen, and others say, no, join all of the promises, meaning don't show any movies until they're all loaded.
Yes. The reason why I wanted to address this one particularly different is that it manages the done differently as well. Because if you do all of these asynchronously, unlike the one above, if there's a failure in the one above and just the chained ones, if there's a failure in one, none of the other ones are executed. But in this one, they're all executed, right? Because they're all executed asynchronously. But you still do have the ability to have an error handler at each one of those, so that if one of them fails, then you can respond accordingly.
And stated differently, when they're chained directly on top of each other, as you know, chained function calls are going to just execute in the reverse order. So the last one is going to execute and on up to the first. And so that's why that last one's not going to, why none of the other ones are going to even get called.
Thank you. Excellent. So I think that's all I have there on the error handling. The key ingredient is be preemptive. Take a preemptive strike against anything that could cause errors. And in JavaScript, let's face it, there's a lot of things that can cause potential undesirable consequences in your code, such as the misuse of any kind of data. So try to strike that. Look at the double ampersands, look at the double pipelines, look for opportunities to actually test and see that everything is okay before you actually use it, and then you'll find that your code's probably going to go a lot smoother. And again, I highly recommend that anytime there is some kind of an error, there's something that you could do that would capture that message somehow, especially in a debugging environment, so that you can go in and say, okay, I can see here that this message was done. It'll save you lots of time from having to walk through the code yourself in Visual Studio.
There you go. That's how to handle your errors. Now we want to talk more on the deployment side. This is kind of my project's done. There's a bunch of other things I need to be concerned about. I need to be concerned about there. The errors, the trial functionality, how to monetize my app, how to publish it. I need to talk about how to test my app and how to diagnose problems in my app and create a monitoring strategy. Now, actually, I think now is a good time, though, to talk real quick about a little bit of a divergent subject. I saw it in the chat room earlier. Somebody was asking about multi-touch, and we can't break too much into the multi-touch topic here, but I just happen to have something queued up and I want to show you. Also in the studio here, if you remember last time we had pen-based computers, now we've got these touch-based monitors, which is excellent, and these touch monitors are really great. I think they actually I'm not entirely sure, but I'm pretty sure they have 30-point touch. That means that three people can have all of their fingers, assuming those three people have all their fingers,
right,
on the screen at the same time, and the operating system is going to handle
that. That's wild.
Yeah. So that actually requires a little bit of collaboration between the hardware and the operating system. The monitor has to be able to recognize 30 touches, and so does Windows. It has to as well. So I am going to bring up a really cool website that I go to a lot. This is IE Test Drive. And if I take you back to the beginning of the IE Test Drive, drive, you can see that they lay this out like a Windows 8 app, but this is really just a website. In fact, if I take this out of full screen mode, you can see that I'm just in IE, no big deal, but I'm going to bring that up to full screen mode, and there are a lot of really good samples in here. Some of these test the performance of your app. Some of these are just kind of a show off of the various new features in IE 10 or in Windows 8. As you may know, IE 10 and Windows 8 are sharing the same Chakra and Trident engines. And so, like this one, for instance, is really testing your processor big time. You can even turn it up and really crank up the number of bubbles that are in the room and look down here at the bottom and make sure that you're still cranking at 60 frames per second or something like that. But the one I really want to show you to show off this monitor and to show off the engine and to show off the whole multi-point touch system that is inherent in the platform is called Browser Surface. Now with Browser Surface, you've got a whole bay of pictures here, and you can filter them so that only certain pictures are available. And then these pictures are, you know, objects that are laid out on the table. And I have to remind people at this point, this is running in the browser. This is not a local app. It's running in the browser. But because IE10's engine is HTML and CSS, and because the CSS is hardware accelerated, we get really good performance out of this. Okay, you'd get the same performance out of whatever on the web. Now I can grab these images and I can stretch them up large and move them around, and that's just two fingers. I can grab two of these images with 4 points of touch. Oops, I dropped one of them back into the tray. With 4 points of touch, or I can even try to get fancy and capture more than four. Now I've got 8 points of touch on the screen. I'm dragging these around, and as hopefully you can see in the online video, there's not really any lag or anything like that. So pretty awesome here, this platform. I definitely encourage you to go to IE Test Drive, look at all the stuff that's available to you in here, and just kind of use that to show off a little bit. It's pretty fun. Okay, back to the topic at hand. We're in the middle of talking about deployment stuff, and the next one is a test strategy. So, I'm behind the times here. All right. So, if Dwight Schrute does not test and Chuck Norris does not test, then why do we have to test? Well, we have to test. Your app is going to be tested. Make sure that it's by you and not by your users, okay? Very important that you go through a rigorous test strategy. We're actually looking to create a test plan that's comprehensive, and then follow that plan, execute that plan, and make that plan as automated as possible so that in iterations of your development cycle, you're going to be able to just apply all of these automated tests and have the confidence of knowing that everything's going to work just fine.
I think the reason why I really am excited about this being part of this module is we just talked about error handling, which is, you know, preventing exceptions and errors from happening. What I really like about this section is that it also provides that concrete feeling of, and not only are we not going to have errors, but the predictability of the application is bound to go up, because we're not only just preventing errors, we're also making sure that the actual user experience is in line and harmony with what our requirements are. And that's what makes this really, really cool.
Yeah.
Especially for JavaScript.
Yeah, totally. Especially in JavaScript. I always say there are a few things that give a developer security. One of them is a good hierarchical error or exception handling approach, where exceptions are caught locally, they're passed up if necessary and caught at, say, a page level, and then they're passed up and caught at an application level, and by any means the exceptions are going to be caught. That's one thing that gives a developer a lot of security. Another is a really good source control system. So get your source control system down pat and get everybody up to speed on it, because that's going to be your lifeline. And another is your unit tests. I mean, your unit tests are what tell you when you make a change that theoretically you didn't break anything in that change. And that gives you the confidence to go do some refactoring.
Absolutely. So when you say, I'll play the person who might be watching and saying, I keep hearing about unit tests, but maybe they work at a shop where that just wasn't formally introduced. So how would you define what a unit test is?
Well, a unit test is having good unit tests. I've heard it said is like making sure you have clean underwear.
Oh,
it's just an absolute essential for the day. Don't even ask the question. Just make sure you have good unit tests, because the unit tests are what tell you that the code that you're writing is doing what it's supposed to do, that it's meeting the requirements. And so if you don't have good unit tests, that means that either you don't have clear requirements or you don't have clear communication with the issuer of your requirements. Okay? So unit tests are really just functionality that executes your code in every way that it's supposed to be executed, and assures that it does what it is that it's fulfills the requirements that it's intending to fulfill.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's really just code that's written, and you know there's lots of different frameworks for unit tests, and I get the question a lot, what kind of framework should I use in JavaScript? You know, in your C# world, you have really good, well-tried, mature frameworks, and you've got really good tooling in Visual Studio for running all your unit tests, and then you enter the JavaScript world and you're like, I'm a little bit lost. Where are my unit tests?
Guess you just have to start from scratch.
Yeah, I guess you'll just have to watch the rest of this module.
Don't!
So, before we get to unit tests, are just one piece of the puzzle, though. Okay, they're just the clean underwear piece, right?
Oh boy,
there's a whole lot more to a good test plan.
This isn't in your slides, I hope. The underwear piece.
The rest of it is. Okay, so a comprehensive test plan does this. Quite simply stated, a test plan is a document that states in great detail how an app is going to be tested. What a successful or a operational or an error-free app means. What is your definition of that? So really, it contains, typically it contains things like all your product scenarios. This is the high-level user stories these are all the things our app can do. And then your tests or your assertions that it does them. Okay, so it's going to contain a description of these scenarios, and then it contains a description of all the test cases that support these scenarios. So I said it will return to you a function that is the addition of two numbers. And now here's a test that will add two numbers together and give it to you. So I'm asserting that that's true. Okay?
Cool.
Finally, a good and thorough test plan describes even the software that's going to be used for doing the testing itself. Now, introducing Microsoft Test Manager.
What?
Test Manager is installed with more professional or test-oriented versions of Visual Studio. I'm going to bring it up on my machine real quick. I'm just going to type MTM, and you can see Microsoft Test Manager pops up. And when I run that, Microsoft Test Manager gives me the option for connecting to a server. I believe I already have... Nope. So I'm going to change my project, and I'm going to connect to a server. And here I'm connecting to my TFS server, and I'm grabbing any random project, and I'm hitting connect. And then I can jump into and pull information out of that TFS instance and populate Microsoft Test Manager with that. Now, my instance, the app I happened to choose there didn't have a test plan of any kind, so kind of airing my dirty laundry there, but I do have some slides that show off what MTM does for us. Actually, before we jump into there, I'm going to show you what MTM does. It manages all your tests, whether those are manual tests, unit tests, integration tests, or even UI tests, and it allows that integration with TFS, a place to store those test cases even, and the automated tests. And it also allows the testers to record all of the steps that they experience leading up to a bug. And it gives you, the developer, really rich information about the bug that they encountered. That's really helpful. So here's what you see when you look in MTM. This is actually looking at a project that's done by our product Patterns and Practices group. The Patterns and Practices group is a great one to be tuned into. Like, go read their white papers and look at the projects that they're creating, because their whole effort, their whole goal is to show you the best and right way to write your applications. If you're looking for good architectural patterns, if you're looking for good code patterns, good testing patterns, go to the Patterns and Practices group at Microsoft and read about what they have available to you online. It's really helpful. So they've got this project that I'm going to show you the testing plan and the unit tests in this project, because it's really complete and really good.
Good.
And let me just admit right now, this is confession time.
Uh-oh.
The test plan And the unit test suite in CodeShow is somewhat less than stellar.
What?
In fact, I'm just getting it going. So if you...
I've been misled.
Well, it works, right?
It does work.
Hey, I'm playing the Dwight Schrute
sure.
right now.
Sure.
So I am actually ramping up the test plan and the, right. and the unit tests in CodeShow as we speak. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you're great at this, please fork CodeShow and do some pull requests and help me out with some of the test plans.
Oh, boy, that's funny.
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay, so the terminology in Git is
True.
Just hysterical.
It is.
All right, so we're going to be looking at Hilo.js, a great example of test plan and unit testing. Okay.
What is Hilo?
Hilo is a city in Hawaii.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yep. There's another project, a sister project called Kona.
True.
Yeah, well, so it's not only a city in Hawaii, it's also the project name for a relatively low scope, pretty simple app that just manages some pictures on your computer.
Right.
But it does so following these patterns and practices, so it's a really good one to go grab.
Yeah, so that's really it's not so much what it's doing as much as it is, it's like that full package of this is all the good stuff behind the scenes.
Yep, this is the right way to do it. You can go to hilojs.codeplex.com. Mm-hmm. It's stored on CodePlex, but in case you don't know, on CodePlex, as in TFS, you can store your projects using Git. In fact, that's exactly how CodeShow works. It's stored in CodePlex, but it's using the source control of Git. Really super exciting.
Very cool.
Because that means that I can jump into hilojs.codeplex.com, go to the source code, clone, and now I have that clone link. I just go to my Git shell and type git clone that, and all of a sudden I've got a folder called Hilo with not just the project, but the project and all of its history.
That's awesome.
In all of its glory.
That is very cool.
Very cool. Okay, so this is the Hilo project.
Okay.
I've obviously already got this one downloaded. It's like a cooking show, so this is coming out of the oven here.
Oh,
so I've
good
got
analogy.
I've got the project all loaded up, and what you can see is, you know what, before I get into the unit testing, I meant to show you the test manager first, because I think that'll give you a little bit of context. So, I don't have that running anymore. I was showing that in the slides. Forgive me, it's the end of the day. Here we go.
I'm ready.
Here's the test plan for Hilo.js, and you can see that I don't even have everything expanded on the side, but this is very comprehensive. And the crop test cases, for instance, cover everything that I might do in the function of cropping images in my app.
So, wow.
So cropping images is one of the things that this app should let me do, and this is the portion of my test suite, my test plan, that details how to test that cropping works.
That's cool.
Now, some of these may require UI user interaction. I might need to log into the app, load a picture, do a crop, and then read the steps of this individual tests plan, this test step, and verify that it works. So I might have steps like this. First, pinch and stretch, and then do it holding the control key, and so on, and you are successful if it semantically, in this case, semantically zooms out, semantically zooms in, okay? Now, whether it's automated or not, this test plan has to be comprehensive. If it's automated, you see the associated automation here? You can associate the automation with this test plan, with a step in this test plan, and now your test plan can run that step without any user interaction.
Nice.
Yeah. Oops. All right, so that's MTM, but what about unit testing?
Yeah.
So I'm going to open Hilo. Hilo is a WinJS project, but in my solution, I have both the Hilo project and the Hilo.specifications project. Now, the specifications project is just a test project. It's called specifications. It's another way of saying tests. And in fact, there's a specs folder, and that's really just the folder that contains all of your tests. Okay. This project is sitting directly next to Hilo, and it is itself a Windows 8 JavaScript project. Okay. Now, in other frameworks, you might be testing binary code, testing a class library, for instance. And so you might have a test suite, and your test project is just hitting a class library and testing these objects. But sure. when we're testing these Windows 8 specific things, like we're testing something coming out of windows.ui.popups, I need access to those mm-hmm. namespaces. And so it's important to set my test project as itself a Windows 8 app. Okay? Now, if I want to run Hilo, I make sure that this project is selected as my startup project. And if I want to run the test project, I set this one. So let's go ahead and run Hilo, just get an idea of what this app is all about. Nice little splash screen, shows me my pictures. Not too exciting. Why? Because there are no pictures on this PC. If I had some pictures, they would be showing here. Yes. It would be beautiful. Push the believe button. It would be beautiful.
I see.
All right, but that's the Hilo project. In this case, we're not actually concerned with the project itself. We're concerned with the testing of it. Okay. So if I look at this specs project, I can see that inside of it, I have Hilo, and it has a red X on it. Is that strange or what?
That is strange.
This is essentially a linked reference to this project. Okay? So the reason why it's linked is because if I just had a hard reference to it, then every time I made a change in the main project, I would have to make those changes in the subproject of my Hilo Specs project as well. I don't want to do that. And so what I can do is I can go into, you can actually drag, you can actually add existing files into a project. You've probably all done this before, add existing item. But perhaps you haven't done this where you choose an item from the sister project, in this case the Hilo project. You choose a file, and instead of adding it by clicking add, you mm-hmm. can add it as a link. Now it Whoa. Will add that as a link, keep it in its original location, but logically make it part of this app. Cool. So you could do it one by one, but good luck with that. It's going to take you a long time.
Yeah, it would.
Another option is to go into the specifications folder and say, you know what, unload this project, and now right-click on this and edit the JS proj file, and it's going to give me the XML that represents that project. And you can see that right now I have project links to all of the individual files. Mm-hmm. Another option, another way to do that is instead of including a link to all the individual files, you can actually include a link to just the Hilo folder. Okay? And when you do that, it links in the whole folder and all of its subfiles, and the world is a happy place.
That's cool.
Yep. So that's kind of the logistics. I'm going to go ahead and close this down, reload this project. There we are, back where we were intended. I can see all the stuff from my other project, but everything's a link. Nothing's actually there. Everything's just a link. Now I can right-click on my specs project and say, this is the project I want to run.
Interesting.
Now, for our unit testing, we could do this all cowboy style, not have any framework, any library, any help. We could just write it ourselves.
Okay.
But we would end up making ourselves some helper functions, a little bit easier way to do an assert. We would find various shortcuts, right, to make our life easier?
I believe we would.
And I believe the same. We would end up writing ourselves a test framework. Correct. Why do that over again? I suggest you use one that already exists, and the one that I suggest is Mocha.
Mocha.
Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, I forgot that the links to these are not available. That's great, because I'll get to walk you through this. When you include mm-hmm. Mocha in your app, when you clone the Hilo.js project, you need to do this, because Mocha and Chai are not currently in the project. Hmm. And there's a reminder here in the README, and it even gives you the link. Here's where to go to get Mocha.
So in other words, Mocha and Chai, these are not part of the MTM thing.
Correct.
This is something else that is a recommendation or an idea to bring into this.
Yep. Exactly. And as a matter of fact, they're not even part of the JavaScript apps in Windows 8. It's just a third-party library. That's actually one of the things that I love the most about doing JavaScript in Windows, is the fact that there are, I think there's approximately a gabillion different JavaScript libraries that are out there mm-hmm. that you can just latch onto.
I read the same, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I think there's a NuGet, but I don't The last time I did this, I looked for it this way, and I'm going to do it again. Just wait with me here. Wait for the download link. That wasn't it. Okay, so let me go ahead and just grab the generally available here. Click here. There it is. This is where I'm searching for download. Doesn't have it. Where's the Mocha.js? Got to get this showing. Let me try Nougat. We all love Nougat, right?
Yes.
At the end of the day, maybe not as much, but certainly in the morning. Love, and I love Mocha in the morning too.
Maybe not under updates, but put it on the online.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Paired programming at its finest.
Give it a chance.
Mocha. Install. And I'm not positive that it'll put it in the right library, but that's, oh, it actually did. That's great. Now let's look for Chai. Install that one. It did not put it under the right location. That's okay. We're going to grab Chai from here and move it into here and delete that. And now we should be good. All right. We all like to watch code happen, though, right?
It's very true.
Yeah, it's very true. So now I've got Hilo specifications set as the startup project. I've got all my dependencies brought in.
Okay.
And this project, as you download it, contains a whole bunch of tests, and we'll look at one of those in just a second. But first, let's just run all the unit tests and make sure that Hilo is working. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Set it as my startup project. Let's go. No whammies, no whammies, no whammies. Good. Okay, the tests are running. Everything just shows up in one log div right here, you know, takes the whole screen. It's just a blank app. Mocha gives us a little bit of feedback on the top right, and we basically get feedback that all of our tests passed.
Now, the question I have for you is, you brought Mocha into this project, but we also had to go re-download it. Was Mocha part of the original MSDN sample, or was this a modified version of the Hilo?
So Hilo is available on MSDN. It's also hosted in CodePlex at hilojs.codeplex.com, and we went and got that version from CodePlex, mm-hmm. and it had those place savers. In other words, the project was pointing to the Mocha.js and the Chai.js, but they weren't actually in there.
I see.
Because they want, probably because they want you to get the latest version of them.
I see.
And
I
so
see.
We just went to Nougat, found Mocha, found Chai, downloaded them, dropped them into that right folder.
But the tests that used them were still part
exactly.
of the project.
They're just the libraries. Yeah,
sure.
They didn't contain any information about our test suite. Okay, so we see that 110 tests passed and zero of them failed, and it took 2.3 seconds to run all of those tests.
Sweet.
Very cool. Let's go take a glance at just one test and see what it is that these tests are even doing. If we look under specs at the pictures and look at the picture spec, a few things happening here. Now, this is kind of Mocha-specific syntax, this description, before, and so on. We're describing a thing called picture view model, and then before is run one time before anything in this test suite, anything in this spec is executed.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Now, before each is a function that's run before each of the individual components of this test suite are run.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So before this thing gets done, we call a shared method to load some images. They might be test images. And in this case, they definitely are. We're not loading the actual images on the user's computer because we can't count on that data being there, as in our case. And then, I love that there's really good comments in each of these. Before each of the tests, we want to get a file here, and we want to create the view model. And then we want to create a number of tests. And remember, these tests are assertions. So we're describing a test and saying when the underlying thumbnail is present, it should have the same name as the underlying file. That's one of the tests that we want to assert. We want to make sure that that is true. And so we go ahead and write whatever contents it takes to make sure that that is true. In this case, we're looking for equality between file name and the view model name. If there's anything different between those, this test fails. Okay? In fact, let's go look at a failure. So I'll just add some garbage on the end of that. Now, these are no longer going to compare correctly, right?
I agree with you.
It's going to be wrong. It's going to throw an exception. And in fact, you can put anything inside your test case that you want that throws an exception. So you could use any other test frameworks that throw exceptions, and they'll work just fine inside of this library. So let's run this again and see what it looks like to fail a test. Whammy! Look at that.
Sweet.
That one unit test failed. Let's say, I love that you're cheering my exceptions. The one unit test that failed was the fact that the underlying file name and the view model name are supposed to be the same. And you can see here that 001JPEG is not equal to 001JPEG dot, dot, dot. That's true. It gives us a little bit of context, tells us where this happened, and gives us a nice feedback that only 109 tests pass. We now have, ourselves, a fully working test unit test suite that we can write against our app, and we can use to determine that our app is currently working in every sense.
That is awesome. I like it.
Yeah, I do too. Yep, so I'm recommending that you create this as a Windows 8 project, that you use Mocha as your framework. Just do it like Hilo. Go ahead and clone that project and use that as your starting point.
Cool.
I believe we have one more section that remains.
We do, but we're kind of on that final descent coming in. And as I stated before, this is one of these kind of topics where what a way to cheer on and champion and say, yay, Visual Studio team for really putting some thought into something that really could be a challenge. And that is when you are... I love what we've done up to this point. We've talked about how to reduce problems. We've talked now about how we can implement tests and even go to that next level of saying, okay, now we have that desired functionality and what we're expecting is going to happen. But even if we do all of that, there's going to be a time where we still might be challenged with resource contention, or there could be, why does it seem to be running slow? Even if we've done everything up to this point, we could have that challenge. So one of the things that we have to keep in mind with our applications is how can we create and design and have in mind what we're going to do when we're developing our applications and we run into these kind of issues. How can we troubleshoot them other than a guess? Guessing sometimes is good, and sometimes it's not good. But what's better than guessing is data. Data actually gives us information that we can use to intelligently make choices. Having a hunch is just that, and following that rabbit hole can lead to much time unnecessarily being wasted trying to chase something that perhaps with the right kind of data, you could have found it just like this. Now, what I'm about to demonstrate for you is going to be how you can engage with Visual Studio to fully analyze a project, get plenty of data about it. But because this is so, it's one of those things that Jeremy was talking about, we can go in so many different directions here. I highly encourage you to really play. This is the last thing we're demoing for this whole thing today. This is one of those things that you're going to want to sit down and truly play with. But I'm going to give you a sneak peek of what the possibilities are. And I think once you see, if you've never seen this before, it's especially cool. It's, from my opinion, it's cool because this is for JavaScript apps. Sometimes we can see that things like this might have been done for strongly typed languages, but this is for JavaScript, and not exclusively, of course, within Visual Studio, but it's a player in the game. So what am I talking about? Well, I've loaded into Visual Studio. In fact, I just one of the MSDN libraries, that samples that we were looking at today. So I have the animation library currently loaded in here. What I want to do is, as I was discussing before, I want to make sure that I can analyze issues or or start to create baseline behaviors for things. So to demonstrate that, you'll notice at the very top of Visual Studio, there is an analyze up here. And what that means is there is the capability within Visual Studio to allow us to address and create profiling sessions, performance sessions that give us the ability to try to track things that can go on through the use of this app. So let me give you a sampling of what this is like. I'm here in the Analyze, and you'll notice that Alt F2, or this first option here, says let's go ahead and start a performance analysis. And then the second one here says, okay, let's go ahead and pause that analysis. Of course, closing the application is going to shut down that analysis. But let me start a simple analysis, and then we'll just take a sneak peek at what the potential and the opportunities are. And then, of course, I'm sure you're going to be dying to load your own apps into here and start doing the same thing. So I'll start the performance analysis. Now, notice when I did that, it launched my app. So I did not go click on a green arrow somewhere. I just clicked on start the analysis. But it did launch the app. But it's now running in the context of this analysis. If I start doing things such as running an animation, animate to a sample page and go back, show content, run an animation, reset, transition between you know, there's a dual purpose in all of this, by the way. I felt like I didn't have time for this before. So now I'm demonstrating all these nice features, right? This is great. Click, click, click. So you're getting to see all of it anyway, but it's falling in line. What's happening is everything I'm doing right now is being recorded and addressed and actually monitored to the nth degree. I think I'm content with what I've done. So I'm going to shut down the app, go back to Visual Studio. Yes. Profiler is stopping. So I'm allowing it to gather its information, and the profiling is complete. What does this mean? You know, it means that over here, which I had hidden intentionally, and I'll go ahead and pin this now, I have under Performance Explorer, see, I have a report. This report is going to give me information about everything that I just did and at so many different levels of instrumentation. So let me double click it. It says analyzing the report could take a while based on what was done. And now we have the instrumentation. This is what's called the summary page. It's listing for me. I think this is so awesome. Check this out. Functions with the most individual work. So it's really taking, it's looking at all the functions that did the most work, and it's giving us an idea of, okay, where's the time going? So right away, what's this saying? Well, this is giving us an opportunity to start to see where is the workload in our app, and where am I calling a pen child? Are there other options? And we could start doing some research there if we're starting to see some bottlenecks. So that's for starter. But then we can cruise in here and start to look at some of these other views, like the call tree. You know, this is meaning from the very beginning, this is the host that was running in, and then we can start to see what called what throughout the entire process of this. And I can drill down, but you'll notice again all the number of calls, the time each of these took. We might be able to say, you know, it seems like when we go here, this is where the issues are. Here's a way you can start to figure that out through the call tree. Let's look through another one. These were all the loaded modules in this application. And again, we could start to see, well, of course, the base.js had a huge number of calls that were made to it. Well, of course, we're going to make a whole bunch of calls there. But then we might be looking at some of our others. Well, default.js had, from our perspective, because we're doing some calls, it had 24, looking at the time. What's another one? The caller callee. So scrolling down, we're looking at functions that were called by global code. I love that. The ability to see what was called in the global space. That's excellent. just a functions report in general. How many, these are all the functions that were called. I mean, I don't know about you, but this is exciting. We have JavaScript instrumentation here. We can analyze every single one of these as our application's running. The processes. You know, we can see what's going on here. And you know, this is also very interesting when you're running this and you have a background task. So give that a try. Also, let's take a look at function details. So this is a very rich UI that will give us the ability to start to really see some metrics that can be used. And then, of course, this is a snapshot of this current instance of the report. Then you can create other reports, and you'll notice in the analyze that then you can compare performance reports. Maybe now you have made some tweaks based on some of the research you've done. You want to see if it made a difference. You could do that analysis comparison as well. So, as I stated earlier, of course, we could just go crazy on that particular module in terms of all the different, you know, possibilities that there are. But my goodness, just knowing that that's there, if no one has ever seen that before, especially for JavaScript stuff, please, please, please start using that. Take advantage of those reports. And the other thing that's in there is filtering. So it's available to be filtered so that you can go in there and say, okay, I want to start to restrict it down to this level set. Go right ahead. What an amazing way to start to monitor the performance and the capabilities within your app. And it's all based on the usage and usage scenarios that you can bring to the table. So I really like that.
That's really cool.
I think so.
Well, does it seem like we've covered the content?
Yes.
Is everybody ready for, are you going to go out and take the 7482 exam tomorrow? Is that right?
I'm telling you.
That's the way to do it. Yeah. Give it a couple days. Let all the information settle in. Actually, like I said before, definitely go visit the official certification, the official exam site, and look at the skills measured. And you'll see it's directly maps to what we tried to cover today, but we're not able to cover everything. So go look at those and get on Bing and look at the areas that you don't feel confident in, and open up some of the MSDN samples, open up the demos in CodeShow, and write some of your own code and get on top of all those concepts. The tests are awesome because they're kind of a bar. You know, you do the test and now you know that you know that content. It's a great personal milestone.
Yes, and I know that so many people have benefited from the previous jump starts that came from this, and we were so excited to see all the results. But I think a common thread, even though there were some that said, oh, we just watched the jump start and that's all we needed to do in order to pass the exam, I think this one particular being an advanced jump start, you really owe it to yourself to do what Jeremy said. You watch the jumpstart, but then you need to really get your, you know, hands dirty, so to speak. Get into the code, start to play around with this stuff. That's what's going to make the impression up here, as well as going and seeing what the actual exam requirements are. The other thing that you can do, and I should mention that prior to joining Microsoft, I worked for a Gold Learning Partner as an instructor. So I loved teaching all this kind of stuff. And sometimes people would really like to take and benefit from, you know, full week classes or whatever the case might be. So don't hesitate to look for a Microsoft training partner and see if you can benefit from something like that as well.
Yeah. And also remember that we're really at a unique point where you've got an incredible opportunity in the Windows Store at a time when such an enormous platform is just ramping up, just released last October, and things are apps are flying around like crazy right now. So it's a really unique time. And we also have a really unique offer right now where Michael and I are available for office hours. So you can just do kind of some one-on-one, get on the phone, get on the horn. And if you're at the final stretches in your app and you just need to kind of get over the hump and get it into the store, if you've got some kind of abstract, like just, you know, tell me the concept or tell me generally how I submit to the store. What are they looking for? Or, you know, look at this app, tell me if you think this is going to make it into the store. Or if you're on the other end of the spectrum and you're just starting with your app and you're just like, I've got an idea. I've got a great idea for an app. I just need to turn it into reality. Definitely just set up some office hours with us. Carve out some time and we'd be glad to sit with you and walk you through questions like that.
That's for sure. And don't delay. Don't miss out on this opportunity. It's so exciting right now to be at the beginning of this very huge emerging store opportunity. Get your apps built. If you have to, think of something that would be small, maybe for that first app to get in, so you can get the process down, Understand the store requirements. But don't wait, don't delay. Get something out there now. Get yourself into that store. We would love to hear your success stories.
Oh, yeah.
Not only that you passed the exam, but if you have apps out there, we want to know about them. We want to look at them.
Sure.
You saw that I actually, in front of the whole crowd, I even demoed a few of the apps that were created by the community members themselves. I would love to continue that trend and see what you're doing too. So if you do happen to put an app in the store, let us know. Tweet about it. Give us the link so that we can see it, and we're excited about that kind of stuff.
And stay in touch with the two of us at Palermo4 on Twitter, and Michael's website is palermo4.com. Mm-hmm. And you can book office hours with him at ohours.org/Palermo4. So nice being consistent there.
That's correct. And he's also consistent with his at CodeFoster, CodeFoster.com. And wouldn't you know it, ohours.org/CodeFoster. It's so easy.
Consistent.
It's very easy.
Well, I think that concludes all the modules for the series. You are now officially trained on 7482 and ready for the exam, or maybe not. Who knows? Make sure that you've got all the bases covered and then go take it. Actually, I suggest that you sign up for your exam and get it on the calendar, even if it's 3 months out. That way, you will study to meet the deadline. Okay?
That's right.
So go ahead and get that certification. Fill the whole certification suite out and get the whole certification. Have fun doing it. And we look forward to seeing you more on MVA. So take care. We're done.
Cheers.
Bye.